Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Matt Cowan from Mondak Marine in Glasgow, Montana. Matt is a longtime friend of the JMO crew, and he's a wealth of information, and he's been fishing for a long time on a high level. And Matt, he's caught a ton of giant walleyes. But he also, as we learned last time we had him on, he spent a ton of time early on in life as a fly fisherman, dedicated fly fisherman. And this interview, I really tried to tap into that as much as I could because, you know, fly anglers, you know, fishing in current, in drift boats, or whether you're wade fishing or bank fishing, whatever, you know, rivers, that's a big topic for those of us walleye anglers this spring is, you know, the big opportunities and destinations are rivers, and reading water is a big topic of conversation with Matt in this. And he does a great job sort of blending the two worlds together. As a fly angler with no electronics, and how to be efficient and successful, and then the important takeaways from that that you can bring in, then add the electronics portion of the conversation, but yeah, still focusing on being efficient and making good decisions and covering enough water and doing the right things, presenting a natural bait. Just some great topics that we hit on in this, and Matt has a really fun take. And I don't think that I've really asked anybody about fly fishing experience on this podcast. So again, just another fun one for me and Matt. Just couldn't appreciate his time anymore. He's a great guy. So let's get to it here. We got Matt Cowan. We're talking about spring walleye, spring river fishing, reading water, being efficient, just all the great things. We get into it. Let's do it.
Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations, and to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description.
We're all looking to have the ultimate edge on the water, but how do we get there? When it comes to fishing rods, JT Outdoor Products has you covered. Their technique-specific rods are engineered and tested by tournament professionals to give you the competitive advantage on the tournament trail, or the extra edge to the passionate everyday angler. They're hand-built in Farmington, Minnesota. With the highest grade carbon fiber blanks and the finest componentry, JT rods are ultra lightweight, incredibly sensitive, and built for performance. Whether you're after walleye, bass, pike, or panfish, they have every species covered. Their rods deliver precision, durability, and unmatched feel. Don't settle for ordinary. Fish smarter with JT Outdoor Products, where performance meets perfection. Visit them at jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Do yourself a favor, check them out today. TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. If you're going to be doing any boat rigging whatsoever this season, check out a complete listing of products at tkicnc.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. The boat market, man. Mondak Marine, Glasgow, Montana, man. What's I'm just sort of curious, maybe for a quick and dirty, what's business been like? What are you seeing in the boat market? What can you tell me? What's the fun talkers there?
Well, you know, one, just super thankful to be in this community and servicing a very wide range of customers. And, you know, things are really looking up here in the first quarter. I'm thankful for that. You know, still trying to be conservative on some of the decisions on the business side, just making sure we're doing the right things for the right reasons. But overall, you know, we made it through a pretty chilly winter and the ice is breaking up and people are excited to get their boats out and our schedule's filling up. So overall, it's a strong presentation from Crestliner, Warrior, Camus, and Yarcraft for me. And availability is good with those companies, along with Mercury, which is our number one motor out here at Mondak. So the supply chain is, you know, not too bad. It's not a year out anymore. It's 3-4 months, which is kind of nice on a special order boat. As far as the electronics and rigging goes, you know, that's a never ending battle with people just trying to get better. So with the addition of lithium batteries here and there and just good clean power, of course, the forward facing sonar system is still It can be a hot topic if you want it to be, but it's not going away from what I can see. I am seeing a lot more customers allow me to help them with portable forward-facing sonar systems because they're so darn expensive. Guys are, I'm building, TKI is the company that I partner with, Tom, out of Billings, a local company. And I'm building these portable shuttles that guys can put on their boat in the front, in the back, or take it to their buddy's boat, or put it on a jet boat. I've even had guys use it in drift boats. You know, it's pretty sweet to be able to do that in open water systems, not to mention you can always use it in the ice world as well. So that's been really popular.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, that's, you know, it's such an investment anymore. You got to look at it that way. We're not, you know, it's like we're buying toys, but it used to be so fun and easy because things weren't quite so expensive. Now it's like we're going to buy a toy for our boat that costs, you know, $2,500, you know, just for kind of the stream. You can be more expensive than that than you want. So yeah, you guys got to be flexible with it if you can. And
yeah, we all don't get to use our boats and our electronics as much as we want to, just due to our shortened season up here. But I'm seeing a big charge in that once I explain to customers that it doesn't have to be a permanent system just in the bow of your boat. I mean, you can put a permanent system in the bow and put another one in back for your co-angler so that they're not staring over your shoulder all day, and it's a little bit more relaxing. So, you know, it's not going away. We're just trying to figure out how to make it easier for everybody once they decide they want to jump in to that forward-facing sonar world and hopefully enjoy it.
Is, you know, talking about, you know, like the lithium batteries and, you know, that's been a big portion of our conversations and a lot of conversations, is understanding the, like the power draw and needs has got to be a big part of that. Is that, you know, is that a question that you get very often, or is that pretty easy to sort of explain?
Yeah, it just starts with building a very strong, powerful foundation that starts with your battery. And it doesn't have to be lithium. You know, the AGM batteries, right, they do a good job. You know, the bigger 31 series wet cells, they do a good job. It's just you don't get as many recharges through those, and it's not consistent full power throughout the whole cycle like you do in a lithium. I mean, you know, I partnered with Norsk and Dakota Lithium, and Norsk is coming out with some pretty sweet systems on a 16-volt battery that is designed just for clean power for your electronics. You know, 135 amp hour heated core, and it Bluetooths with your cell phone so you can see it all. The technology is always changing.
You know, as far as business goes, what do you spend most of your time talking with customers about or thinking about or anything else, answering questions, anything else that we could should address? Just get a little bit of an update in the boat market here.
Yeah, you know, it always comes down to, you know, the service side, making sure that the boat and the motor is doing what it's supposed to do and it's reliable. You know, that's a big deal. But inevitably, most of the conversations turn to electronics, whether it's trolling motors or sonars or, you know, the networking capabilities and some of the things that you can do with your trolling motor, you know, when it's paired with, in this case, I'm going to use Humminbird in the One Boat Network. That's just, it's fun to see that light switch turn on a customer, even when you just talk about simple things like following a contour. It's all about efficiency, right? I mean, there are so many good anglers that have been so successful doing things that they're proficient at. And there are some guys that can drive a trolling motor with a foot pedal and still hammer fish all day long. I'm not one of those guys.
Same.
I will use as much technology that I can to help boat control, because at the end of the day, whoever is on the fish with the best boat control usually gets them.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to interview Pete Harsh on this podcast, you know, a few years ago. But in preparation to interviewing him, you know, I was reading like some of his articles and just things from way back in his career. And he did this seminar, or included this in, like, I don't know how many, you know, thousands of seminars or hundreds of seminars he did over the years. But, you know, one of his big quotes was like, something to the effect of, you know, there's three things that catch walleyes: boat control, and boat control.
There you go.
And I just got a big kick out of that, you know, and that was his big deal, you know, Mr. Tiller. He's, you know, back troller. And yeah, man, that was his deal, man. Like, oh my gosh, you couldn't, I don't even know if there was like an RTK GPS type of, you know, any kind of technology even still to this day that could draw trace lines as straight as that, man. You know, I mean, he was just like, dude was just like unreal. But yeah.
Lots of experience.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. And then once it pays off for you and you just realize like, man, when you put a pattern together and it's happening that way and those fish are in that zone and you stay in it. Yeah, that's the stuff, man. That's the juice. That's every conversation we ever have about fishing is we're just trying to prepare ourselves to go out and do that, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And speaking of fishing, man, have you been fantasizing about any? Have you been doing any lately? What's the updates? I haven't talked to you in a while, man. Have you been doing any fishing, anything from the last time we talked that would be some highlights?
Well, you know, I have to be careful because I'm starting to take for granted how awesome it is to be at the shores of Fort Peck whenever I want. And I catch myself, you know, not being thankful for that. So, you know, the ice is leaving. I think Nelson Reservoir here just west of Glasgow is open. I drove by it yesterday. The shores are starting to break free on Fort Peck. Of course, the Missouri River below Fort Peck is open. Guys are getting out. You know, I haven't been out a ton. I've probably been out 3-4 times in the last month, mostly with my jet boat on the river. But water conditions are good. We've got some good snow pack in the mountains, and we're hoping that we can hold some water back this year and not have another 10 to 15 foot drop around here. So we'll see.
I didn't really say much, you know, before I called here about having a conversation. So I'm hoping you're down for this, but to get into some fishing topics with you is easy because we can, there's a lot of things we can talk about, but I'm hoping you're down for this. This is a reference to the first time having you on the podcast. Wasn't the first time, like, you and I had known each other for a few years and everything else, but last time you were on the podcast, or the first time you were on the podcast, you talked about, which I didn't know this about you, but you talked about your experience in fly fishing. And so I want to tap into that with, you know, reading water and, you know, how to find fish or figure out, you know, how to make that perfect cast. What is it that a bunch of us, like Neanderthal walleye anglers with traditional fishing tackle or, you know, spin tackle, can take away from somebody like you who has experience on both ends of that spectrum, you know, to kind of bring those two together and have some meaningful takeaways there?
Sure. Funny you say that. I was out in Bristol, Indiana this last week looking at a tritune pontoon line, and we drove over a river. I think it was called the St. John's River, maybe in South Bend in that vicinity. And I actually had to pull over and look at it because the first thing that came to my mind is, where are the fish going to live on a river like this? But all rivers are the same. There's current breaks, there's eddies, you know, there's shallow, there's deep, there's different transitions and substrates from gravel to mud to rock. And it all comes down to food. I mean, that's the goal, is those fish want to work as little as they can, but yet be as close to a constant food supply that they can find. So when you think about it that way, why are there drive up windows at fast food? Because it's easy. We don't have to get out of our car. So a fish is going to be on a current break or a seam where they don't have to move very far to find food. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're at the top end of the current or riffle. They could be at the bottom end. You still got to search for them. But once you start finding spots that hold fish, pay attention to what the current is doing. And there's always current in most every reservoir lake that I've ever fished, somewhere, whether it's wind-driven or just natural current. And those fish are just following food. They just don't want to work that hard. So I can't just say, well, go to the top end of a riffle and start fishing. Well, for trout, they position themselves different in a river than walleyes or pike or bass. So you still got to do some searching. But one of the things that I've learned specifically fishing the Missouri River is, once I find a current break, let's just say I go spot lock on it, and I just slow my side imaging down, and I can see those fish swimming on the left or the right side of the boat. It's not like forward-facing sonar because it's not real-time imagery, but those fish are 60 feet to the right, 60 feet to the left, and I've got friends that I tell them, cast over there, there's a fish. Sometimes they get them, sometimes they don't, but it sure is fun when everything is kind of full circle and works.
But you said something there definitely to point out, you know, with your electronics, like a tip or a trick there. I kind of want to dig into your side imaging there where, you know, adjusting the settings where if you're searching for fish, say it's walleyes and you're a side scan, that's a, you know, on the Missouri River, any river, side imaging is like, for so many people and for good reason, side imaging is like the one thing you would want in your boat.
100%.
Other than a GPS, not to run into, you know, trees and rocks and sandbars. But like from a fishing standpoint, I kind of want to sit on the side imaging thing for a second. And then different situations where having the know-how to know what situation you're in to adjust your settings like throughout the day. That's such an interesting topic because I would be the kind of guy that, you know, I wouldn't like, I don't mess with my settings nearly enough on the water. So this would be like a big tip.
Sure.
For me.
Well, it's all my number one tool other than my Lake Master map is 100% my side imaging. And I usually, when I get the opportunity to get in a boat and help a customer go through settings and electronics and things like that, there's so much technology in our electronics that you can feel overwhelmed pretty darn quick. So we just break it down, and I love talking about side imaging. Obviously, how far out you look has a lot to do with what you're going to be able to see. I still recommend, let's just say on a 12-inch graph, you know, 70 feet on each side, only because that's about as far as I can cast a quarter ounce jig in a plastic. So it doesn't really, unless I'm just searching a big, vast basin looking for some sort of structure, it's usually 70, 80 feet is what I'm looking. But the key is to adjust your scroll speed to your water speed. And you don't necessarily have to with the new mega imaging, so to speak, because it's pretty darn clean. But if I like to drive around and look for structure fish at about 2 to 3 miles an hour, so I like the cleanest picture that I can get. So mimic your water speed with your chart speed or scroll speed. So put it on 3 and drive around. If you like the way it looks, perfect. If you don't like the way it looks, change it. And not just the speed, the color palettes. There's lots there because everybody's eyes are different. I love color palette 11. That's my favorite one on Humminbird. I think I can see it the best. It gives me a red return on hard surfaces, and I'm used to red with just traditional 2D. So it allows my brain to pick it up a little bit quicker. But once let's just say I've found some fish and I spot lock, you can crank your chart speed up to 10 and everything is going by really quick, fairly crisp, but those fish, sometimes they're going by quick, but I find a lot of times that the walleyes are at a constant speed and they're moving more than I ever thought. With the use of forward facing sonar, I've learned a lot about how walleyes move, but sometimes I'll crank it up. Sometimes I'll crank it down. When I do crank that scroll speed or chart speed down, they draw a really long line on my screen, and it's a lot easier to see, especially if they're in that beam for a significant period of time. And they're there, and you can cast to them. Sometimes you get them, sometimes you don't. But if you're not using forward-facing sonar and you have a unit with side imaging and you're not paying attention to that, you're missing out because that technology is right at your fingertips. Make yourself drive by a boat dock or a ramp that comes into the water because you can see what it looks like outside the water. And then you see what it looks like on your graph. You can see the size of the rocks. Let's say they're 20-inch boulders on the side of a boat ramp. Well, they're going to be 20-inch boulders in the water too. So it gives you a good point of reference to say, oh, that's a 20-inch boulder. If I drive by a walleye and it's bigger than that, well, there you go. It's bigger than 20 inches or smaller. It gives you another point of reference.
You know, that side imaging, like you said, when you park just right and that beam is kind of pointed over towards where some fish are, and you can sort of see where sometimes the fish are holding, or sometimes you park on some fish and you realize that the fish aren't holding there, but fish are cycling through. I think that those little things that happen can be really meaningful sometimes that day, but even just in the long run, understanding the pattern, like,
yeah, you know, springtime, we all know the walleyes are only have one thing on their mind. You know, they're going to go spawn. So they're moving, but you have to remember that sometimes you have to set up below them or above them and pitch above them based off of current. I personally prefer to set up above them and cast at about a 45 back and then sweep that jig up through them. I seem to have had more luck that way than to actually try to keep that jig at a perpendicular with the current, similar to in the fly fishing world, you would mend your line so that your fly has zero drag on it, right? I get a lot. I enjoy a sweep with the current below me. And that's not just with a jig. That can be a crankbait. That can be stripping streamers, fly fishing. Sometimes just a different angle with that current triggers them to go.
TKI CNC produces reliable, meticulously crafted marine components for every fishing adventure. If you're going to be doing any boat rigging whatsoever this season, check out a complete listing of products at TKICNC.com. There you'll find lots of things, including the multi-purpose rod holders and their forward sonar pole mounting kits. These product designs specifically maximize your efficiency and reliability in the boat. This is why so many hardcore anglers, including tournament anglers, are turning to TKI to accessorize their boats. For a detailed look or in-depth tutorials, check them out on YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram at TKICNC. We're all looking to have the ultimate edge on the water, but how do we get there? When it comes to fishing rods, JT Outdoor Products has you covered. Their technique-specific rods are engineered and tested by tournament professionals to give you the competitive advantage on the tournament trail or the extra edge to the passionate everyday angler. They're hand-built in Farmington, Minnesota. With the highest grade carbon fiber blanks and the finest componentry, JT rods are ultra lightweight, incredibly sensitive, and built for performance. Whether you're after walleye, bass, pike, or panfish, they have every species covered. Their rods deliver precision, durability, and unmatched feel. Don't settle for ordinary. Fish smarter with JT Outdoor Products, where performance meets perfection. Visit them at jtodp.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. Do yourself a favor, check them out today. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations. And to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description. Dude, you just got my gears turning with that reference to mending your line as a fly angler, where... Isn't it true that every time we try to jig or manipulate our jig, like jigging a minnow or jigging a plastic as a walleye angler, like every time we do that, we think we're giving life to our presentation. But the reality is that we're probably doing something that isn't exactly the natural thing that their forage is doing. And fly anglers understand that you got to mend that line to keep it,
you know, when a salmon fly or a caddis lands on top of the water, it's not swimming. It's just floating. No extra movements. It's just chilling, or grasshopper, or pick whatever. So that's always the goal, especially when you're fishing dries, is to have zero drag on your fly. And that's tough in current, because usually you're casting towards a current break, which means the water is slower on one side or the other. Or you're at the top end of a run and you're trying to get it to just float natural through the sweet spot. There, a lot can be learned doing the same thing with terminal tackle. You know, jigs obviously are the number one thing, but when a minnow is just swimming through the water, it's not just, and it's a healthy minnow, it's not just randomly jumping up and down, is it? I haven't seen them do that.
Right.
Usually
right.
They're just swimming. So that's where that 45 degree down current, and I'm not popping the jig vertical. Sometimes that works. I'm more parallel to the water surface. Pull it up, let it fall back down. Pull it up, let it fall back down. It's kind of like a minnow just slowly going up the current. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading more into it than I should, but I've had a lot of success that way.
Yeah, but it's those little details that'll make or break for you. You know, sometimes we maybe force the meaning, you know, just to kind of maybe overthink the explanation. But I think those little details, you know, matter, you know, for one reason or another. When you're out on the water, there's always, if you've got three guys in the boat and one guy's just really wailing on them, like, you know, that's why we got to pay attention to what that guy's doing, because there is a fine detail probably happening. Angle of the cast.
He's probably not going to tell you what he's doing either.
Right. Sometimes we don't even know, right? Like, yep, like me, I'm not smart enough to know why maybe I'm getting them or why I'm not. That's probably my bigger issue, is when I'm not getting them more often, I just don't know what to do to get them. But it's those types of things, I think, where, you know, understanding that there's more than one way to skin the cat. And if you're seeing fish and they're on site imaging, they're staying, you know, there's a spot there that's holding fish, and you can understand that portion. Understanding that, your retrieve, the cast angle, like how long is it staying in the zone where the fish are? Yeah. Are you getting that bottom contact? But there's definitely there would definitely be advantages, I feel like, to be, you know, somebody like yourself that has that type of experience on both ends of the spectrum, where you can just think that way, just probably so much easier.
It's fun to be able to see the water and kind of think you have an idea where the fish should live. But that all stems from me growing up in, you know, Western Montana, or I guess more Central Montana, and big timber fishing super high mountain streams that sometimes are only 10 feet wide. With giant boulders, you just can't help but learn that there are fish living behind those boulders, because that's the soft current. That's where they live. And you cast in to 700 pockets behind boulders and you get fish. That's what taught me the most. And then you learn more about riffles and runs and things like that as you move into bigger, you know, streams and rivers. But, you know, another little tip that most people don't think is, when you're fishing a river and you have the ability to work your way upstream, that's a good thing, because all the fish that I know, when they're sitting still, which way are they facing in the current? They're facing upriver, specifically on the trout side. Well, I can sneak up on trout a lot easier walking upriver than I can downriver, because they're already looking at me if I'm walking downriver. So sometimes I use that analogy a little bit and think about that when I'm in a jet boat on a bigger river. I think those fish hold a little bit longer for me with, you know, the noise of the motors and things like that when I'm going up current, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you're going to approach a spot in a boat, or you're going to drive over a spot, that makes a lot of sense. Definitely pay attention to... And early in the spring, this is like one thing that all the river rats that I know, like, if it's your first time out, always fish upriver or the boat ramp anyways.
So if your motor doesn't work, you can come back home.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
That way, if something happens and all you got left is your trolling motor, you know, if the big engine goes kaput on you or whatever, you're struggling, you can't get her started. The current will bring you back to the boat. Bring you back to the dock.
Yeah, we've all been there, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, man. That's a good point. You know, somebody like me, you know, again, you know, people that fish rivers all the time, you know, they just understand this stuff. I think, too, what a great reference to and great experience for you fishing small rivers, where there's just so many similarities, where I think, you know, for me, I didn't grow up on rivers, and so these rivers are very intimidating to me. As far as like where to start looking for fish, what a good spot looks like.
Sure.
You know, I'm not intimidated to gain the experience. I just don't have endless amounts of time to get out there. And so when I do have time, I'm always so anxious that I'm just not doing what, you know, I'm not being efficient. I'm not doing it right. I'm just sort of, you know, just big picture. It's sort of an intimidating task to go out and put together a pattern and have a good day of fishing. But, you know, fishing those small rivers is just, yeah, it's just a smaller version of a bigger river where, you know, you look at a boulder that's,
a certain size on a river that's only 10 feet wide, you know, okay, so now I got a river that's, you know, 500 yards wide and, you know, but relative speaking, that particular sandbar takes up, you know, this amount of space and breaks this amount of water. And there's the depth change. It's like, you know, yeah, it's just, bigger version, smaller version.
Well, look for those current breaks. There's only one reason why there's a current break. There's some object that is in front of it that is splitting the water coming down. And behind that object is the smoothest, calmest water. Like you said, a 500 yard wide river, there's got to be some sort of structure out there, whether it's a wing dam, whether it's just a transition in depth. And the Missouri River is a perfect example of that by Bismarck. From my limited experience on it, there's a lot of awesome sand and gravel. That's why those fish are moving up there. But there's current breaks underneath that water that you can't see just by looking at it. But when you look at your graph, when you go by it, let's say it goes from 5 to 15 feet in a very short distance. Well, behind that drop, there's less current, which the food kind of flows through there. And that's usually a great place to start looking for fish. Transition lines, depth changes. You know, we have the technology at our fingers. When you're not used to a lake, I mean, when you go to your favorite lake or your river, you have a tendency just to go to your favorite spot because you've caught them there in the past. Well, make yourself look at the graph between where you put in and that spot. You might find something that you didn't realize was there.
You know, with that, if you work backwards from a little bit of success where, and you kind of, you know, teach yourself a little bit about, you know, what made this particular spot special. One thing that definitely I feel like can pay off is like, and I'm sure you've had this experience fly fishing where sometimes they're not there at that time, like when you discover a good looking spot, but you just got to bank that like, you know, there's going to be a day when the pattern's just right. Like, you know, like I got to check on that spot every time I come by.
Yep. They're going to be there eventually.
Yeah,
yep, absolutely. Doesn't take you very long to drive by it. You know, the electronic side of things, they can't hide from you. They're either there or they're not, and you can sure cover a lot of ground, where in the fly fishing world, you just keep moving because you don't have any electronics. You have polarized sunglasses and your favorite rod and your favorite fly, you know, and away you go. I can't see into the deep pockets. You just fish them with your favorite bugs and you keep moving, and eventually you get them. No different than when we walleye fish. It's just sometimes we get stuck in a rut. And I shouldn't say just walleye. It could be smallmouth. It can be northern pike.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, salmon, lake trout. We know the gig out here. We've got some awesome species to target. But if you find fish and they're not going, don't forget about them. You can always come back and check them. But if you don't find any fish, don't fish there.
Dude, yeah, I like the way you say, you know, without electronics, that's where, right, like with electronics that we can get bogged down. Because we see fish so, you know, we can be around fish so easily, you know,
yeah.
and we have so much tackle that, well, they didn't bite this. So then I just, you know, I can just spend all day wearing myself out on a school that ends up being suckers, you know,
right.
Like, and I never even find that out because I never catch one. Listening to you talk about fly fishing, a small stream with no electronics or anything, where just figure out what you're capable of on foot. And put your confidence bait in your hand and cast into another. It's a calculated loss on how many fish you're going to go past.
Yep. You know, you're going to spook them. Yep. But you're moving on. It's a mindset that, all right, I've fished this to the best of my ability. Now I'm moving on, you know, and you're going to get them. Obviously, fly fishing is a little bit different because they call it matching the hatch. You're not going to throw grasshoppers in February, right? You're going to throw them in July and August. So you got to pay a little bit of attention, which is a direct correlation to multi-species fishing. You know, the mm-hmm. size of your bait during certain times of the year is different based off of the size of the minnows that are spawning or have spawned or that are growing, you know, things like that. So sometimes I think we just get so, like you said, bogged down with the technology that I would venture to guess that during the peak multi-species fishing season, just call it June, July, and August, you could probably fit every single one of your favorite lures in your front pocket and just have as much success as if you had $20,000 worth of tackle in your boat.
Yep. And relatively speaking, even trollers, you know, even guys that troll that have, you know, an enclosed trailer full of crankbaits, you know, that's so situational that even those guys could, you know, could probably go out with like one or two slides of cranks.
Yeah. You give them a dozen crankbaits in July, they're going to use them anyway, even if they have 1,000 different colors and sizes, makes and models. If things aren't working the way that they should, they're going to go back to their favorites. We all do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You get so much of your work gets done with, you know, that 1% of your confidence baits that you've had that success, it's proven, you know, and I think that's true too. It's fun to buy baits. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, I'm having worked at Shields for 20 years. I am a yeah. warehouse here.
Yeah. I love it. But that's, You know, I'm always thinking situational, or I'm just, you know, as far as buying tackle, it's like I can think of a handful of reasons that justify my tackle purchases. But when you're just talking like this, when you're just talking about being efficient on the water, there's so much, you know, there's just so much to that. And I can I think one of my big inefficiencies is just always been that, like, mentally, I could never wrap my head around, like, I understand the math behind covering water and that calculated loss of, like, well, there's a certain amount of fish that, you know, yeah, you could have slowed down and made another cast and maybe that fish would have bit, and, or maybe you could have switched colors and that fish would have pounced on it or whatever. Like, I understand that, but, you know, the inefficiency of just sitting on fish that are not biting, that could be junk fish, they could be the fish that you're after, but it's just, you know, like understanding, that moving and grooving and checking more spots, trying to contact more fish. It's like, I can do that so easily when I'm mule deer hunting or elk hunting. Like, I can, like, but sure, for some reason, fishing, that has been one of the, like, well, I consider it a big graduation when I feel like I was pretty efficient on it on a particular day. When I feel like I fished efficiently, I'm always like, you know, I just kind of clap for myself, because it's, you know, that is a tough one for me, man.
It is. Go on a float. If you ever get the opportunity to go fly fishing or spin fishing on a river in a drift boat or a raft, you don't get the opportunity to go back up river. You're floating from point A to point B, and you're fishing to the best of your ability when you're going through those runs. Most of the time when I was guiding, I mean, there were 15-mile floats that we would do. You just hammer it. Away you go. You don't get to turn around and go back up and hit it again. You're moving on to the next run, unless you go to shore and walk up, of course. But you can do that in the rivers with prop boats or jet boats. Just make yourself float. Float. Pitch the seams. Great. If you get them, not, there's 1,000 more seams coming up downriver. You know, just be efficient.
Yeah. And after, like, you know, say, you know, 4 to 6 hours of doing that, you're going to know more than you thought you knew.
Oh, sure. Right? You learn every time you go. You should learn every time you go. Especially if you're using electronics, you know, make yourself learn stuff. It's so much fun to see how fish react. And yet sometimes I just turn them off too. Don't get me wrong. I love electronics. I do. 100%. They make you a better angler for sure, especially with the technology. But sometimes, you know, I turn them off and just have my map on and turn all pinging off, because I know the fish are there and I know I'm reading more into it, but I know those fish can feel those pulses going through the water.
Oh, yeah. Because
I'm not the only one out there with electronics, you know.
I like that. I just like that. Like, those have been some of what you're talking, like, my gears are turning so much right now for the opportunities that I'm hoping to have here this spring. Like, I'm just thinking about really paying attention to my jig cadence and not, you know, not overworking it. Cause I feel like I can do that so much for walleyes, you know, in the spring.
I mean, we've all been jigging with a jig in the minnow in the spring, and you fish and fish, you might get a few. And pretty soon you just put the rod in the rod holder and you walk back to get a sandwich and you come back and the rod's bent over.
Yeah.
Right? We've all had that happen. Well, why? Why did that happen? It was sitting completely still, a foot off the bottom in 20 feet of water. I'll be the first to tell you, my biggest walleye that I've caught on Fort Peck, that's exactly how it happened. Sitting still. I went back to grab a sandwich and a Coke and came back and I had a 14-pound walleye on the bottom of my rod.
I love it, dude.
Yeah, it wasn't anything that I did. I just happened to be in a spot where there were fish, and I got tired of pitching and put the rod holder, or rod in the rod holder, came back, and all the buddies that I was with thought that it was the craziest thing ever. And it's just like, well, they want it vertical, so we'll just hold it vertical and we'll just go slow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it wasn't anything you did. I don't know about that. I mean, you got to be around fish like that. You got to be around them. And that is so much of the battle, so much of what we're talking about, right? It's like, you know, figuring out the type of spot where a fish might be, and figuring out that stretch of river where that core population of fish might be, you know, doing their deal, you know, like you say in the spring.
You got to be around them. Yep.
Yeah, you got to be around them, and then figuring out how to make them bite in those situations where, yeah, do I stay or do I go, and how do I do this, and, you know, the efficiencies or whatever. But yeah, I think that there's just, there's so many of those just little things, little ideas that somebody else's, you know, personal stories and experiences can just be so meaningful and have a light bulb go off, you know, for somebody like me, or, you know, just listening to you talk about this stuff. And I think it's great. I think the references to your experience fishing small, you know, streams, small rivers, and fly fishing, and just how you read water without electronics, and then it's more than that. It's understanding the efficiency of covering water, where, well, what do I do if I don't have electronics? Well, I can just cover as much water and cast into as many good looking spots as I can, and then and move on. You don't sit and cast on a spot just because it looks so good. It looks exactly like, you know, the last spot where you got, you know, two fish, you got two good bites out of a spot or whatever. And like the next time you see a spot exactly like that, you just assume, no, man, it's like, you know, you got to get out of your own way and be efficient. And then once you get electronics, again, somebody like me, that can be such a big setback, because now I know I'm around fish so often, and that was so hard for me before. So I'm just wearing that like a badge of honor, but it's still not putting more fish in the boat. Why? Well, because, yeah, like, it's slowing me down. So then you got to get back on that efficiency train and try to create that balance, you know, as far as your strategy and approach. And
absolutely. Dude, I think on Fort Peck specifically, I know I drive by so many fish and so many spots that I don't even know are there, yet I've fished it a lot. I've learned a lot the last few years. Simply, when I put my boat in, we all think, well, let's race to our favorite spot, whether it's 1 mile away or 70 miles away. The last time I went on Fort Peck, I didn't even fire up my big motor. I started fishing right from the boat ramp, and I found spots that held fish within a half a mile of the boat ramp that honestly were just as good as the spots that were 20 miles away. So, and that's just all from just looking at my graph. And that doesn't mean that I caught more or less. I just found stuff a lot closer to home. And I know that's the case in a lot of places, because what's the first thing we all want to do when our boat is fired up? And, you know, if you have hair, unlike me, feel the wind in your hair.
Yeah. Go and get after it. Finding new fish.
Yeah.
Or having a new understanding is fun, man. And we're definitely out there to have fun.
It's a good game.
Yeah, yep. Dude. Yeah. 100%, dude. I would have been stoked if I was with you that day, and you could see the boat ramp. It's 400 yards away, and it's like, man, I've been fishing here for years, and I've been using this boat ramp for years. I've never caught a fish within sight of it. How come? Well, I guess I've never fished within sight of it.
Never made myself just stop and say, okay, there's got to be fish here. It's Fort Peck.
Yeah,
that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to get them, but I sure didn't burn much gas that day. You want to know what really made me learn that? Funny story. I was fishing a walleye tournament down the dry arm here on Fort Peck at Rock Creek with my oldest son. And the day before the tournament, I smoked my big motor. And there was zero chance. I mean, he's like 9 years old. There was zero chance that I was going to fold and not fish that tournament. So I had a kicker and my bow mount, and away we went. And we fished all the stuff within a couple of miles of the ramp and had a ball that day. Didn't have to run very far, but some people would just be like, I'm done. I'm going home. I'm not fishing the tournament.
Yeah.
we only get to fish so much. And if you decide you're not going to make it fun, that's on you. But I'm not that guy. We're going to have fun regardless if stuff doesn't work.
Yeah. Think about your own self when you were 9 years old. Could you ever forgive yourself later in life? If you start thinking that way, you start getting to the point where you can't go unless everything is perfect. Right. Yep. But think back when you were 9 years old, you would have killed for, your dad to take you out of school for a half a day to go fishing in a duck boat. You know what I'm
Absolutely.
Saying? It's like, man, be that guy, be that person, be that yep. younger version of yourself that just lives with that pure passion.
Just go fishing. Have fun. Just go fishing. We all, trust me, when your kids get older, like you're finding out, you don't get those times back. So make the most of the ones you get.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is that time of year, man. Well, all times of year, ice fishing is very inclusive. Like anybody can go. You don't have to have big fancy gear. But this spring, where a lot of fish are moving shallow, multi-species, but I mean, definitely walleyes. But a lot of fish are living shallow. They're coming in to spawn they're coming in to chase bait with all this moving water. Fishing from shore is such a big deal.
Absolutely.
Even if you do have a big fancy boat, you're still, you're fishing within a long cast from shore. And yeah, it's like, it's definitely that time of year where just try to capitalize on every possible opportunity that you have in some way, shape, or form. Because it's just the opportunities are exceedingly abundant for sure.
They are. We're pretty darn lucky.
Yeah. Right on. Well, Matt, we're good on time, and I just appreciate the conversation where we can just kick back and talk about fishing and just fun.
I enjoy it too, Taylor. Thanks for having me, man. Absolutely.
Anything else that we should hit on that you feel like is like a fun, important thing to talk about this time of year for fishing, or anything, business related, talking about Mondac Marine, anything you got going on there, anything that we should promote or just throw out there, you think?
No, I think we've covered most everything we need. It's always fun just to have general conversations and not too specific. Hopefully your customers appreciate just talking about the passions in our lives. So like I said before, I was on, if anybody wants to get a hold of me, they can call me here at Mondac in Glasgow, Montana, just 406-228-2900. And, if you have any questions or have issues with electronics or things not working the way you think they should, give me a ring. We can figure it out.
Yeah. I highly recommend. You were working for Shields when you and I met.
Yep.
I wasn't even working for Jason Mitchell. Actually, I was just a buddy of Jason's at that time.
Boy, did we hammer those fish on Devil's Lake through the ice.
Yeah, we met in Devil's Lake. It was kind of a little, you Shields guys were getting together, and Jason had invited me fishing, and it's like, yeah, man. Then you fast forward,
that was 20 years ago, Taylor.
Honestly, yeah, because when I think about then shortly after that, I started doing things for Jason and started working for Jason. I think back to that particular time, like that weekend meeting all you guys was kind of the origin story of me working for Jason. But technically, like I didn't work for him for another, like basically the following, another 9-10 months after that. So it's like, you were like part of the origin story of me getting to know Jason and then eventually working for him. And then, so yeah, I've known you. The industry, people that I've met through this industry, which has been wonderful and great. Like, our friendship is like one of the originals for me. So I don't know.
Deep roots, buddy.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.